This recording is the property of the Winogrand Foundation and cannot be used, quoted, transcribed, or otherwise rebroadcast without the express permission of the Foundation. This is the New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section Lecture Series for April 3rd, 2013, The Problem with Fundamentalism and Other Liberal Myths about Religion.
It always amazes me how it works out. We normally have just enough chairs. Okay, I'm Leslie Aiello. I'm president of the foundation, and I want to welcome you all here for our panel discussion on fundamentalism. And with this, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff, who will probably turn it over to Rudy. Is this right?
Hi, everybody. I'm Jeff Moskowski. I, along with Rudy Gaudio, who's on the panel tonight, are co-chairs of the New York Academy of Sciences and Anthropology section. We'd like to welcome you all to tonight's event. I'm sure everybody can hear me. So welcome tonight. We'd like to, as per usual, we want to thank Winogrand for hosting these events. It's always a wonderful opportunity for us to come together here, and we have a great crowd tonight on a very exciting topic. So we're very pleased that you came, and we're very pleased also to have this incredible panel that we've for tonight's event. Before I introduce the speakers and the panel, I want to also just announce that on April 29th, we'll have our final event for the season. That is a Monday. We're returning back to our Monday schedule from 7 to 9 p.m. With a dinner proceeding and a reception called Cartographies of Racial Democracy, Race, Affect, and the Production of Abject Subjects Among Brazilians and Puerto Ricans in Newark. And the speaker is going to be Ana Ramos Zayas. So that should be a great event for us, and we hope to see all of you there. Tonight, if you're familiar with the New York Academy of Sciences at Winogrand program, you see that we typically have one speaker and then maybe a discussant, but we also have been introducing panel discussions along the way on topics that are of concern across many different kind of subdisciplines within anthropology and in interdisciplinary frameworks. And this is the panel that we put together for this year, and it emerged organically from the anthropology section coming together to think about topical issues and thinking about ways of addressing them in a kind of dynamic format with speakers. So what I'm going to do to facilitate tonight's event is to just simply introduce the speakers for tonight's panel and the panel itself. And then I'm just going to introduce them all at the beginning, and then they're going to speak one after the other. And then after they make their comments, we'll open for conversation. I'm not going to make lengthy introductions because you will learn about much of their work through the comments that they make, but I will introduce them all. The panel itself is called The Problem with Fundamentalism and Other Liberal Myths about Religion, and it came about in order to think through some of the problems with designating and labeling something as some sort of religious practice or belief as fundamentalist, and what kinds of questions are foreclosed through that kind of labeling practice, and what kind of questions we might want to open up by decentering that idea. And we have four spectacular people on the panel. Our first speaker tonight is going to be Sophie Bourque-James, who's from the CUNY Graduate Center. She's finishing her dissertation, which is called The Political Ethics of Intimacy in U.S. Evangelicalism. And we're very looking forward to seeing that, Sophie, because it's, as one of her committee members, I have to say. No. So we're very excited to have Sophie here. We also have Omri Elisha, who's from Queens College, CUNY, and he has a book out, which is fantastic, called Moral Ambition, Mobilization, and Social Outreach in Evangelical Megachurches. Our third speaker is Isla Fader from Fordham University, and she has a book called Mitzvah Girls, Bringing Up the Next Generation of Hasidic Girls in Brooklyn. And our fourth speaker is our co-chair, Rudy Gaudio, from SUNY Purchase, and he has a book called Allah Made Us Sexual Outlaws in an Islamic African City. So as you can see, we have a spectacular group of people lined up with spectacular credentials and very interesting things. Their books are all – you have to rush out and buy all of them right away, including Sophie's dissertation, which will be filed any second now. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Soph. And before, please, we're going to circulate. We want to know who you are. We have to keep attendance so we can contact you in the future. So please just sign in and tell us how to contact you by email so we can keep you on your list and notify you of upcoming events. So with that in mind, I'm going to turn it over to Sophie, and then we'll the speakers will speak in, I guess, in which order? Yeah. Okay, you'll do what you're going to do. So welcome, everybody, and thank you all for coming. And
I think you can. Can you hear me now? Okay. So I was saying thank you for being here. As the format of our panel is, we're each going to take a short 5 to 8 minutes talking about our own work and our approach to the question of the panel. And then we're gonna start a discussion amongst ourselves and then open it up to you. So we're hoping to have a lot of kind of questions and engagement from the audience as well. So as Jeff mentioned, the idea for this panel, it started with the Academy was interested in organizing a panel on religion, and my own research is on evangelical megachurches. My research was in Colorado Springs, and so I'm afraid I might have started to try to hijack this panel out of a concern that that I've noticed when presenting on my own research. So as Jeff mentioned, there's, you know, when we use labels like fundamentalism, but for me, I notice even with evangelicalism, labeling religious movements ends up kind of creating these stories in advance. So often people kind of decide in advance what my topic or my research is about. And I notice sometimes I fear lose a little curiosity about the people and the groups that I'm studying because of these stories that are already circulated about what illiberal religious movements, fundamentalist religious movements, or just religious movements in general might elicit in people who have who kind of embrace either liberalism or secularism. Okay. Yes. So my bias is I have a bunch of questions. I'm going to bring up some questions in my presentation, and I'm hoping that through the discussion I'll learn from my colleagues and hopefully this will help with the noise, and hopefully get some more clarity on, for me, how to approach my topic in a way that kind of invites more openness, you know, to the material than foreclosures. So Susan Harding, in an important essay, talked about the topic of fundamentalism and these kind of logical foreclosures that it creates, and how she talks about specifically the Scopes trial around evolution, and how she re-narrates that trial as kind of a struggle over the hegemonic dominant U.S. narrative, whether the U.S. would be defined as more of a kind of Christian religious nation or a liberal modernist secular one, and how the decided victor was a kind of more liberal secular national narrative. But she writes about that in that process, that fundamentalists became, she writes, internally othered and become kind of like the repugnant cultural other. So that when we use the term fundamentalist, it kind of conjures up a lot of ideas about people who may be, illiberal for sure, but also maybe ignorant, maybe not very intellectually curious, stubborn, etc. And so I think that even though I don't use the term fundamentalism or fundamentalist in my own research, I do think that using the term evangelicalism, because it's so well circulated in the media, it conjures up maybe some similar ideas. So as I mentioned, my research is on, it's not just on evangelicalism, it's on evangelical megachurches. I spent 14 months in Colorado Springs participating in Bible study groups and attending megachurches. And my focus is specifically looking at the relationship between evangelical ethics and politics. So how kind of the cultivation of what are seen as kind of religious ethics end up shaping people's political perspectives in a variety of ways. And so specifically talking about politics ends up, I think, reaffirming a lot of my audience, whether it be an anthropological audience or a broader academic audience or just a more liberal secular audience. I worry that sometimes my work and stories from my field work end up kind of reaffirming a lot of stereotypes that people have. And so I kind of question myself as a scholar, how can I try to disrupt some of those stereotypes? And that's why I'm excited to also hear from my colleagues here about their approaches, because I think that those of us who study religion often encounter this. So that's my question, I guess, is how to try to avoid some of these intellectual foreclosures where people retain some curiosity about the kind of cultural movements that I study without deciding in advance what they're about. So that's my question, and I hope that we can talk about that. And then I'll talk about one possible solution that I've been trying to develop in my own work, and that's influenced especially by Saba Mahmood, whose book, The Politics of Piety, studies the women's piety, Islamist piety movement. And in her work, what she's trying to do is she kind of turns the mirror in some ways, so where she starts looking at an illiberal religious movement, but then tries to kind of so that she's also reflecting on what are some of the hidden biases in a more secular, liberal perspective. And so I've been trying to do that in my own work. So, for example, one part of my research, I'm looking specifically at the politics of the family in U.S. evangelicalism. And so part of that is I've been studying what could be described broadly as the ex-gay movement, so people who claim to have left homosexuality. And what I noticed is that in talking about this research with non-evangelicals, it was often the part of my research that people found the most fascinating and maybe troubling. And what I came to see is that there's actually in a more kind of secular understandings about subjectivity is this belief that sexuality is a key component of modern identity, of the individual identity. And it's based on a particular kind of ethics and subjectivity idea versus evangelical ethical ideas about subjectivity, where the individual desire and sexual and other forms of desire are meant to be links to God. So one of the things that I've been trying to do is frame not just kind of the ethical framework of the people that I'm studying, but also thinking about the ethical frameworks that are employed in more secular kind of political positions as well, to show that they have different separate logics, but logics nonetheless. So with that, I've kind of introduced our panel. I've proposed a question and something I'm working through in my own work as a solution, and let me pass it on. Is it?
Yeah. Thank you, Sophie. It's great to be in conversation with all of you three and to be able to explore this with you too. I'm a cultural and linguistic anthropologist who studies contemporary Jewish life in New York City. A majority of my research has been with ultra-Orthodox, mostly Hasidic women and girls, or as I call them in my book, mitzvah girls, non-liberal Jews. So I'd like to explain tonight how I came to use the term non-liberal in my work and also discuss some of the implications, both positive and negative, of my choice to use non-liberal rather than a whole host of other options that I had, such as fundamentalist, which I did use actually for a while, Haredim, which is an increasingly common scholarly and popular Hebrew term for the ultra-Orthodox, or what the community calls itself, which is either Haimish, which means like homey, Jews like us, or Frum, or Hasidish, as in Hasidic. So using the term non-liberal was a decision that I made very consciously as I was writing my book. Back when I was a graduate student and doing the research in Brooklyn, I attempted to limit my focus to Hasidic Jews rather than other strands of ultra-Orthodox Judaism, also known as yeshivish, sort of mirroring the sociological and anthropological literature at the time. However, as I continued with the research, I found that the boundaries between Hasidic and other ultra-Orthodox Jews were rarely clear-cut, and I needed a term to encompass the level of religious stringency and orientation. I needed a term to encompass the level of religious stringency and orientation to the secular world that was shared by a range of ultra-Orthodox Jews. At this point, and it's the 90s, a number of scholars had been using the term charedim, which means those who tremble before God, to refer to ultra-Orthodoxy, particularly in Israel. However, I was really reluctant to use this term for two reasons. First, the Jewish women I was meeting in Brooklyn did not refer to themselves this way at all. They called themselves, as I mentioned, either Hasidish or Haimish or Fromiden, which is religious Jews. Second, I was reluctant to use a Hebrew term in my work since I felt that it further marginalized anthropologists who worked with Jews and Judaism. I wanted to be in a broader theoretical conversation, not just that happening in Jewish studies. So about this time, in the 90s, the Fundamentalist Project, which was a series of edited volumes by Marty and Appleby coming out of University of Chicago, began to be published. These were a comparative series focused on themes shared across religions in the post-war period. So here was a way to engage with scholars, for example, working with evangelical women or Islamists on similar issues. For a while, this was a really productive way for me to look beyond Jews to placing Jewish ultra-Orthodoxy in a broader historical and comparative context. I was inspired by the work of people like Marie Griffith, for example, who back in 1997 talked about gendered agency among evangelical women, or Susan Harding's work that Sophie mentioned on Jerry Falwell and the work of Faye Ginsburg. I thought with the term fundamentalist, I had found a way to theorize new forms of religious revival, which countered the clearly floundering secularization thesis that religion would gradually wither away in the face of modernity. And then 9/11 happened. So I was in the process of writing articles and working on my book. It was during this time period that I began to find the term fundamentalism increasingly problematic. In the more popular media, the term too often implied primitive, backward, and violent forms of religion. When used in conjunction with Islam, it was often tinged with racist undertones. I was also increasingly sensitized to secular Jewish discourses about the ultra-Orthodox, which similarly portrayed them as antithetical to modernity, a throwback to some lost pre-modern past. Secular Jews, in sort of a funny twist on what Sophie said, secular Jews, upon hearing about my research, would make comments to me about Hasidic Jews, that they were embarrassing or, quote, bad for the Jews. For me, this was problematic because I increasingly understood these Jews to be very much part of the modernity that they critiqued, though they themselves lay claim to an unchanging form of Judaism, which they trace from the peak of Mount Sinai all the way to, you know, the streets of Borough Park in Brooklyn. I wanted to be able to portray the women and girls I was meeting in a complex way that accounted for their own portrayal as well as historical accuracy. I especially wanted to be able to highlight the surprisingly porous boundaries that have existed between ultra-Orthodoxy and liberal democracy in the United States, which is based on the Enlightenment principles of governance, including pluralism and tolerance, protection of individual rights, and the relegation of religion to the private sphere. Further, while I appreciated the comparative use of the term fundamentalist in the Fundamentalist Project, its historical specificity to a particular form of Christianity and North American religious life was frustratingly not accurate for the Jews I was working with. I wanted a term to account for Jewish history in pre-war Europe and post-war North America. In addition, the, quote, fundamentalist Jews discussed in the Fundamentalist series were exclusively in Israel. The series was too focused on the nation-state and did not represent what I was seeing in the diasporic context, with its very different issues of citizenship and participation in the state. And then around this time, I began to read Talal Asad's work, and soon after, Saba Mahmoud's Politics of Piety, along with other new approaches to the anthropology of religion, often coming out of the anthropology of Islam and the newer field, the anthropology of Christianity. both of these approaches attended to history and power, to the ways that the secular and the religious created each other in historically and culturally specific ways. It was Mahmoud, in her study of Islamist women in Egypt, particularly on embodied modesty and agency, that struck a chord with my own work on Jewish ultra-Orthodox modesty and agency. Mahmoud used the term non-liberal, and as I wrote my book, I decided I wanted to be in conversation with her and others approaching the study of gender and religion in a similar way. Further, the term non-liberal is historically accurate in that Hasidic Judaism in particular came about in Europe as a reaction to the Jewish Enlightenment, the Haskalah, which itself was a response to the European Enlightenment, a reaction to liberalism. So the term non-liberal encourages comparison to historically similar religious movements without the racist baggage or cultural particularity that fundamentalism has. It also complicates our assumptions about Western modernity in that the Jewish case shows an alternative religious modernity not in post-colonial context only, but right in the heart of cosmopolitan Europe and now New York City. There are certainly problems with the term non-liberal. For me, the biggest drawback is that the term is obscure. Non-academics and many academics do not know what it means. So I often gloss non-liberal by putting fundamentalist or ultra-Orthodox in parentheses or explaining in a footnote why I use the term non-liberal at all. At times, such as when I recently wrote about the sexual abuse scandals in Hasidic communities in New York in a more popular context, I wrote for The Revealer, I did use ultra-Orthodox Jews and decided that I could just sort of gloss non-liberal in the text, but I used ultra-Orthodox since it was specific to a very specific audience. So my hope is that defining non-liberal in familiar terms might challenge stereotypes and change more popular discourse, as Sophie suggested, by drawing attention to historical parallels and differences. And this panel in particular is very encouraging in that way. Thanks.
Well, hi, thank you all for speaking and for coming. I feel a little bit like an outsider insofar as I'm not really an anthropologist of religion per se. If I were to identify myself in terms of subdisciplines, I'm a linguistic anthropologist whose work has largely been on gender and sexuality and more recently urban life and ethnicity and nationalism in Nigeria. So I come at this topic because at doing work in contemporary Nigeria means you don't avoid religion and religiosity. And the work that I did for many years in the predominantly Muslim part of northern Nigeria, focusing on gender sexual minorities, men who are self-identified and identified by others as feminine or woman-like, the religious nature of the society and of these men's lives meant that I have to deal with this issue. And for reasons I'll explain, I have many of the same experiences that my colleagues who focus on religion per se and on communities that cohere around religion, which is everybody here. Even though the community that I've worked with doesn't identify, that's not what is the salient factor that makes them coherent as a group ethnographically, the issues that my colleagues are addressing are very germane to mine. Let me explain what I mean by that. So in northern Nigeria, the research that I did from the early 90s until just a few years ago focuses on these men who in the Hausa language are called Ndaudu, which translates more or less as men who act like women. So I've identified them as gender sexual minorities, even though that terminology is also problematic. That's the safest terminology that I'll use for you. And in the period that I've done my research, northern Nigeria, which has been predominantly Muslim for hundreds of years, became politically Muslim in ways that were new or new again, insofar as in 2000, the predominantly Muslim states, 12 of the 36 states of northern Nigeria in the far north, which are predominantly Muslim, implemented Sharia officially as the laws of those states. Now, Sharia has been, a law of people's lives in this part of the world for hundreds of years, and 200 years ago, there had been a jihad that was inspired by Sharia principles that overthrew nominally Muslim rulers and replaced them with other Muslim rulers. So it's not as if Islam hasn't been a political rallying point in this part of the world before, or that Sharia hasn't been before. But in 2000, it was in a new historical context. Nigeria had been independent for 40 years from Britain, So the period of colonialism, which had lasted 60 to 100 years, depending on which part of the country you're talking about, and the post-colonial period meant that implementing Sharia in a multi-ethnic, multi-religious Nigerian state, post-colonial state, had particular valence that it didn't have, you know, when it had been implemented 200 years earlier after a jihad. This was the middle of the period where I was doing my research with the Ndaudu, these feminine men, and they were one of several groups that became targeted as needing to be kind of put out of the public sphere. Not eliminated, not exterminated, but reformed, like brought to see the light. And most of the discourse was not about arresting them or, like I said, eliminating them. It was more like bringing them to a more observant Muslim way of being. So that's the context. So the research I did, the book that Jeff mentioned, tracks like the way these men express their identities and have responded to the historical circumstances that they have found themselves in and that I observed in the 15 or so years that I was doing my research there. Now, I think one reason that I was drawn to participate in this panel is because I have had, like my colleagues describe, what I call like the experience of talking about your work, and in my case, talking about my work with people who might in one way or another be considered queer, and talking to Western groups, and usually in the United States or other Western societies, who are learned, largely secular, or at least, you know, liberal, if they're religious, they're more of a liberal mindset, who hear that I'm doing research with queers, gays, feminine men, however they want to think about it, in a Muslim society, even when I just say that, without having said Sharia, without having said what happened in 2000, I get this, like that look of oh, I get what you're talking about. So when Sophie was mentioning like, oh, I know what you mean. It's like, how could you possibly know what I mean? You know? I think we're all responding in one way or another to this like, oh, I totally know what you mean. Even though I'm not an anthropologist who's done research with that community, I already know it. And you kind of feel like you're already wanting to have an argument and you don't want to do that. Now, I should say that I don't think we're the only – it's not just anthropologists dealing in religiously – in religious contexts that deal with this. I think any social scientist is going to meet with the prejudices that people have about that topic, whether it's vegetarianism or banks or whatever it is, right? People have ideas and they're going to – like many people will be like, oh, yeah, I totally get what you mean about vegetarians or banks or whatever. But I do think that there's something about religion that – makes it especially difficult and especially vexatious to be addressing. I think if you're dealing with with non-liberal orthodox whatever religious communities, it is especially so. And being an anthropologist who's worked in predominantly Muslim settings, I can say that it's not just the non-liberal expressions of Islam, but Islam itself that seem to trigger this. And the fact that in many of the – we did a pre-circulation of comments so that we got to get a preview of what each of us wanted to talk about before we came tonight. And I was struck by how Islam figured in the background of the work that my colleagues working in Christian or Jewish communities address. And so that given that I work have worked in the Muslim context, I was very alert to that experience. So I've had many of the same issues about how to identify not necessarily the religiosity of the men that I did my work with, but the religious currents that have had an impact on their lives. And no term really seems satisfying for many of the reasons that my colleagues have said. So if I use fundamentalist, it invokes like a North American Christian tradition. Orthodox can mean like that people are observant when in pretty much all the Muslims that I know in Nigeria consider themselves observant. And even though some might consider themselves more orthodox than others, nobody would really cede that turf and say that I am less orthodox than you, even if certain people might want to lay claim to that. And I think the most surprising thing for audiences such as yourself that I might share is that even many of the men that I did my research with, the Ndaudu, when Sharia was being trumpeted as this new thing, were welcoming it, even though the discourse explicitly targeted them. They targeted them, targeted women identified as prostitutes, targeted a number of other social groups that were sort of seen to be inappropriate for a believing Muslim society. many of these men were like, they went to rallies that celebrated the implementation of Sharia, which to me seemed odd, I'll admit. But I remember asking, like, but aren't some of those people saying that they want, like, you to not be around or you not to do what you're doing? And they're like, well, you know, they'll say that, but, you know, but everybody's for Sharia. You have to be for Sharia. We are for God. And so the fact that even the men who seem to be quote-unquote victims or targets, among the victims or targets of certain kinds of political expressions of Islam, are embracing it, at least in some level, to some level, seems to be challenging a lot of the expectations and stereotypes people have. So I basically, thinking strategically, make it a point of emphasizing that. I also make it a point, especially dealing in settings where Muslims are minoritized and stigmatized and even demonized, like in the United States, where I live and work most of the time, to emphasize that in Nigeria today, the Christian parts of Nigeria are no less hostile in the public sphere. The religious and political leaders are no less hostile to gender and sexual minorities, and to some extent are even more so, more vociferous, more vocally anti-gay, anti-same-sex marriage. And so I'll say that. When I do that, I feel like I'm kind of stepping in another pile of poop because I'm addressing, then I'm dealing with the kind of problems that especially Omri and Sophie deal with, which is that I then animate all of these anti-evangelical Christian kind of discourses and prejudices. So we've heard, if you listen to NPR, you know that American evangelicals have been fueling the anti-gay fires in Nigeria. And so if I bring this, sometimes I kind of conveniently remind people of that in order to deflect them from this anti-Muslim direction that they're going. But I'm always feeling a little bit guilty about doing that because I'm, you know, I don't do that if I have time to write. But when you're in conversation, you kind of don't have a choice sometimes strategically to make these moves. And so I can't say that I have a solution to it other than to kind of say that I find myself tactically moving back and forth between different things, emphasizing different facets of the research. I also wanted to say that there are terms that within the anthropology of Islam that people are using that I very much respect and try to accommodate, like the notion of reformist Islam, which is a term that comes up a lot, or Salafi, which is a term that kind of means Puritan. I don't want to use the word Puritan for obvious reasons, but purifying. These terms can be useful, and especially if you're writing in a learned context, they're very useful. But as you said, Ayla, with regard to Hebrew terms, they're often not known to a wider audience, and they can be exoticizing in a different context. But sometimes I do find them useful. And within Nigeria, I've been called on some, when I'm discussing my work by other Nigerianists, for not just using the names of the movements within Nigeria. There are Sufi movements, which are in many ways no less orthodox than some of the other movements. So to characterize them as more liberal would be wrong. There are various movements that might fall under the banner of Islamists, some of which are identified with Shiism, mostly with Sunni traditions, but they're not all in agreement. And so some people have said, I should just use those terms, which again, if I'm speaking to a learned Nigerianist audience or Islamic studies audience works, but in other contexts, it's too opaque. So I think that I'm, especially as a linguist, I'm very welcome to listening to people's ideas, my colleagues here and you, about the different kind of discursive terrain that we're all trying to navigate on this regard. I will say that the other reason that I felt a little bit on the outs in this group is that I'm the only one who's done research research focuses primarily outside the United States. So the term fundamentalist is used less, I find, in the literature that I'm looking at. I think it might have been once upon a time, but I think many people just were so alert to the fact that it didn't have its origins in an African context outside the U.S. that it was kind of people have been doing other things. So that particular term, and when Sophie and I were discussing this months ago, that particular term wasn't really working as a problematic for me. But the discursive problems that everybody's facing are very recognizable to me. So I look forward to hearing your comments as well. Thank you.
So I think it's actually very appropriate that I'm batting cleanup because in addition to joining my colleagues in problematizing some of these terms that we're talking about, I also kind of want to problematize terminology in general, and hope that that also helps us a little bit. Though I don't want to be too radical about it, but hopefully it'll be a more nuanced argument than that. Terminology is always an especially challenging concern for those of us who study religious movements that appear to stand against or in the way of social liberalism and secular modernity. The assumption, of course, is that such groups must share key things in common, at least enough to warrant categorization, if not something close to an ideal type. But very often, the choice to use one term or another, be it words like fundamentalist, ultra-Orthodox, millenarian, right-wing, these terms come packed with a lot of cultural and ideological baggage that we might better avoid, not only because they reflect possibly reflect liberal biases that we may not fully account for, but because they are often also emic categories as well that carry particular meanings for diverse religious and social actors who are differently invested in the moral, political, and social controversies that the labels evoke. The word fundamentalist, for example, and we haven't actually talked yet about the history of that word specifically, the word fundamentalist emerged as a form of self-identification among conservative Protestant defenders of biblical orthodoxy in the early 20th century. By mid-century, the label was sufficiently maligned in public discourse, and we saw the reemergence of the term evangelical as part of a self-conscious term by some moderate fundamentalists away from separatist apocalyptic rancor toward a more engaged and participatory cultural style. Although the evangelicals also reaffirmed the fundamentalist movement's emphases on biblical orthodoxy, evangelism, personal piety, and eschatology. Since that time, we have Christians who continue to call themselves fundamentalists, Christians who don't call themselves fundamentalists but sort of sound and act like fundamentalists. We have semi-fundamentalists who don't like to be too closely associated with fundamentalism or who define themselves by their non-fundamentalism, which then is subject to debate, and so on. The term has become nothing if not more diffuse and arguably less precise, to the point where it's no longer entirely clear whether it's used most accurately to refer to a self-conscious group identity, a religious epithet, or a category of scholarly analysis. Historian George Marsden once defined a fundamentalist as an evangelical who's angry about something. Now, this is a tongue-in-cheek definition, but the statement reveals precisely the loose, highly contingent, subjective, and oppositional nature of the term. The ambiguities are even greater now that the term has expanded to apply to other religious groups, including Muslims, Hindus, and Jews. Along with the problem of bias and meaning, we face the nagging empirical challenge of knowing exactly who it is we are even talking about when we use such terms, and more importantly, who or what we may be ignoring or misrepresenting in the process. This brings me to my own work. My recent book, Moral Ambition, is based on fieldwork with conservative yet socially engaged evangelicals who are dedicated to mobilizing churches to increase their commitments to social outreach, including charitable services to the community and limited forms of social action. I studied religious actors in communities of faith that have inherited and reproduced the legacies of fundamentalism, and thus they're not especially known for this kind of work, this kind of outreach. They're known more often to emphasize preaching and proselytization, and if any kind of activism at all, right-wing political activism, anti-communism, anti-feminism, anti-choice, anti-state. However, these evangelicals that I studied are also descendants of the neo-evangelical response to fundamentalism, which has involved concerted and continuous efforts to promote new forms of altruism, civic participation, social responsibility, and cultural production that engage directly, albeit somewhat ambivalently, with the terms of modernity. Now, while words like fundamentalist and evangelical are always slippery, I have generally found modifiers like non-liberal and conservative to be helpful strategies of clarification. They allow me to highlight and remain mindful of the fact that many of the Bible-believing, church-going Protestants I've studied do not openly subscribe to liberalism in any form, not as a political platform, not as a way of approaching matters of doctrine, and certainly not as some vague social consensus that links human flourishing to individual moral autonomy. Indeed, many of the evangelicals I studied reject such notions, preferring to protect the boundaries of orthodoxy from any hint of liberal secular humanism, which is perceived as morally and spiritually bankrupt. And yet, by characterizing them as conservative or non-liberal, do I not once again run certain epistemological risks, and what might they be? I would argue that when we examine non-liberal religion in a lived empirical sense, we find actually that there are elements in the process of religious identity formation and mobilization that resist or complicate these categories. I don't simply refer to the fact that some evangelicals consider themselves liberal, which is true, but it's a tiny minority. But rather, I'm referring to the fact that, as others have shown, there are within the subcultures of evangelicalism countless ways in which liberal inclinations are internalized or expressed, even if they're only subtle. Ideas of tolerance, pluralism, ecumenism, innovation, feminism, social justice, these paramount values of modern Western liberalism are by no means absent from even the far right corners of American evangelicalism, though admittedly their currency is unstable and precarious compared to the austere and authoritarian morality that generally holds sway in evangelical churches. The point I want to make simply is that on an ethnographic level, there is more to these communities than the sum total of their partisan loyalties, reactionary ideologies, or their stated rejection of social attitudes and public policies categorized as liberal. As in any society, evangelicalism contains internal debates and tensions, uncertainties and inconsistencies, many of which actually become most evident in the context of religious mobilization, since the needs of collective action almost always have a way of bringing a group's intrinsic struggles with itself to the surface. We're witnessing this today with debates over homosexuality and same-sex marriage within evangelical circles. And by the way, I mean, this is true. I predicted this years ago, and we're seeing it played out right now. Same-sex marriage is going to be the new dividing line within evangelical churches, the way that biblical literalism was 30 years ago. I'm convinced of it. And I found this to be the case with socially engaged evangelicals who I studied, who assume unenviable roles in predominantly conservative churches, in that they seek both to embody the religious virtues and imperatives of the larger group, and at the same time to push the boundaries of those virtues and imperatives, to breathe new life and sometimes new ideas into them, even if it means muddying the waters of ideological purity, and even if the results of those provocations remain almost imperceptible, tiny, seemingly inconsequential ripples on the surface of an otherwise well-guarded culture of conformity. But as any sensitive ethnographer knows, conformity is not the same as uniformity. As important as general theoretical categories are, then, our task as scholars must be to commit ourselves to recognizing those tiny ripples that defy the tides. Even when observing orthodoxy, absolutism, and sectarian social organization, our means of classifying what we observe must be able to account for the exceptions, not just because there are always exceptions to the moral norm, but because the moral norms themselves are far from rigid, solid entities. They are assemblages composed of multiple strands, influences, and, yes, exceptions. Strongly religious communities are defined by their internal complexities as much by the coherence of their social and symbolic boundaries. The problem with fundamentalism, then, is thus a problem and an opportunity that goes well beyond fundamentalism. It invites us to consider all the things we can learn by seeing categories in general as imperfect, loaded, and shifting, rather than neatly predictive and comparative. I'm not saying that there are no comparative or theoretical benefits to terminology. On the contrary, I'm suggesting that we begin to reap those benefits when we contextualize our terms historically and reflexively, as we've been doing on this panel, and when we start to pay close attention to cultural phenomena that our terms fail or refuse to describe. These include discrepancies we may observe between what we expect religious fundamentalists, conservatives, and non-liberals to do, and how some of them actually behave. Thank you.
I was just thinking about this non-liberal term. I didn't talk about it too much in my own little spiel, and others did a little bit more. And I'm just struck, just building off other things that my colleagues have said. I mean, there's something when you say non-liberal, you're obviously still highlighting liberalism. But given its hegemony, it makes sense to do so in some context, right? Sometimes you don't want to highlight that hegemony or put everything in its light. But I was struck just by listening to what you were saying, and then Sabah Mahmood's book came up a number of times. And I was just struck, I think one of the things I gained from reading that book and then hearing what some of you've been talking about and just thinking about the ways in which people have interacted with me in my various field sites is the degree to which we keep saying liberalism, but we're not talking about what it's at the root, which is freedom, right? To be free. And the degree to which, like, for many human beings, freedom is not like the primary or the only privileged goal of life. And I just wanted to name that because I think it was kind of lurking unnamed, and I just wanted to say it. And I think that I find that a difficult concept to wrap my brain around for obvious reasons of my own location, where and when I was raised. But just, it's somehow lot obvious, but in other ways really difficult. And I think that many of the times where people are responding, there's this idea that, like, wow, some people don't want to be free, or they don't want other people to be free. And it's like, yeah, that is true, right? That is not the only thing that people find valuable. And like listening to various of you were talking about the ethical principles that motivate people, where freedom is not the only ethos or the motivating ethos. But many things that are in there are good that I can wrap my brain around and sympathize with, I think provides an opening for thinking about ways that we might kind of, disrupt some of the stereotypes and expectations that we're running up against.
I mean, what's particularly interesting, just briefly building on that, is that all of the groups that we're talking about certainly emphasize models of subjective formation that don't highlight the kind of freedom that our audiences are typically assuming. But at the same time, they're all about freedom. Right? I mean, it's all about liberating yourself. Mm. It's a question of what you're liberating yourself from and what guidelines you're using for liberation. But I mean, why did conservative evangelicals align so closely with the Tea Party last year? I mean, it's because it's all about freedom, right? And evangelicals believe that their theology is the root of freedom, both in a cosmic sense and in the Western democratic sense. So it's a very interesting problem and leads to a lot of the misunderstanding and the miscommunication that we're talking about, because there's an assumption that, oh, people in very orthodox religious communities don't want to be free. But in fact, this is actually a very significant category for them, both in the terms of modernity, which then they kind of recalibrate, and in theological terms.
Yeah, I'll just speak to that a little too. And in fact, in teaching my students about my work, I found that one of the most effective things is to sort of name the elephant in the room, which is they don't believe, the people that I work with don't really value tolerance and pluralism. And that really changes the conversation, because then the question is, well, what are they valuing and why don't they and what do they think about those things? So I think once that gets named, it's very effective. And you're right, Omri, about the different forms of subjectivities. It's interesting that all of you have talked about sexuality, which is very interesting, and the freedom to choose, how you're going to be, who you're going to love, all those kinds of things. In some of the work I'm doing now on the ultra-Orthodox or non-liberal Jews and the Internet and people who leave and people who stop believing, one of the real issues that they bring up again and again is they want the freedom to be themselves, to choose who they are. And so they very much adopt those secular terms of subjectivity, which has been really interesting for me to figure out where that leaves me in terms of understanding them morally and ethically. If they're considered to be kind of bad subjects or immoral, or at least in their community sort of crazy, it's often framed as a kind of mental illness if you lose your faith. How are these people themselves understanding their move to stop believing as an ethical step? Are they, or are they seeing themselves as somehow no longer moral people? So these are just really interesting questions.
Yeah, thank you. I have a lot of questions, and I guess I just wanted to also highlight what I noticed as some of the themes that we've talked about, like about how, because it seems like each of us has developed our own strategies about how to kind of unsettle these preconceived ideas in our audience. So I'll just name some of the ones that I've seen. So using stories that kind of unsettle these preconceived narratives, from our kind of strategically taking stories from our field work that unsettle them, choosing different categorizations or labels, but that there's complexity in that. And it was interesting for Rudy and Ayla how the complexity of wanting to, on this one hand, use some emic terms. Right. And I've thought about that with my own work, and hardly anyone calls themselves an evangelical, except for, at least in my field work, except for in jest, where people would be like, yeah, I'm one of those right-wing, you know, Bible-thumping evangelical Christians. Like, that's almost the only time I heard it. But so using kind of emic terms and then the complexity about the kind of the politics of that, but also I really liked what you brought up in terms of also, like, the terms that we use kind of bring us in conversation with certain people or not. And so kind of if we're trying to open more kind of intellectual doors, but then are we shutting other possibilities of conversations, troubling the categories that we use, which I think is also very important and is something like that all anthropologists, no matter what our field sites are, can think about. And then also that demonstrating the different logics, that it's not as though there's no logic within like religious ethical systems, but it's just a different logic. So that's was helpful to think about. Rudy, I just had a question. So these Hausa men, like, who are at these like rallies for Sharia, like, can you talk a little bit more about what they're like, why they're like, how that makes sense to them in terms of why they're so, you know, like, why they're like, of course we're here, like, right, what that logic is.
With them to the rallies, so I wasn't there at that moment. And these rallies were 13 years ago, and most of the men I did my research with have died. So can't really follow up too directly, but from what I can recall, when Sharia was implemented, many people were in favor of it, not because it would rid society of immoral like elements. Or primarily that it would get rid of the prostitutes and the bad people, but the you saw graffiti on the walls a lot that said Sharia is justice in Hausa usually, and many people it's post-colonial Nigeria, there's a kind of, you know, kleptocratic elite class, and a lot of poor people. And so there's a lot of injustice that people face on an everyday basis. And many people were very inspired by the idea that in a righteous kind of Sharia guided polity would bring some of those corrupt, nasty leaders in line. I think many have been disappointed in the last 13 years about where Sharia has, where the focus of enforcement has been. And so there's been a little bit of conflict. But many people were in favor of it because they saw it as bringing in a kind of justice that we might recognize as social justice of a political economic sort. And I think so many people seem to embrace it on those lines. And so many people who might, whose own personal proclivities, like who they like, and these were men who have particular, who have certain kinds of privileges, even if they're poor, to move around the city, find people they want to hang out with for social or sexual reasons, drink a little, gamble a little, do some things that the imams would tell them not to do. Many of them are not really committed to those things as identity markers or to the freedom to do those things, and assumed that they wouldn't necessarily have to stop doing them after Sharia was implemented, but that they would have to be more respectful and mindful of public norms in pursuing them. Just like in Saudi Arabia, some people told me. You know, it's not that these things don't happen, it's that they're kept undercover, which is proper. And so many in Daudu seem to endorse that way of thinking. That's how I understood it.
Mm. Can I just say one thing too? The other thing I wanted to mention is that we've all talked about how we want to break stereotypes and challenge the people that we speak with. But one of my concerns is also how I position myself. I don't want to be an apologist because I do believe in tolerance and pluralism. Let's put that out there, too. And anthropology is a discipline that generally supports that. And so one of the questions that I struggle with all the time is, you know, where my loyalty lies and how to speak with people who might be critical of Hasidic Jews and agree with them and then also add another layer. So it's complicated, and I often find myself saying, well, you don't really understand. They value other things. And then thinking to myself, yeah, but women really might get, you know, part of the raw end of the deal in certain kinds of contexts. So there's a tendency to want to sort of like protect the people you work with, your people. And I think with certain kinds of that repugnant other, you're put in a funny position of, especially with those of us who work in the U.S. as sharing, not space, but citizenship at least, there's the question too of like, yeah, you know, they're the people that I'm working with often misuse government funds or misuse the courts. So do I say nothing? And so I've sort of come to see my role as being, as adding context, but also sometimes taking a stand more than I did before. I've changed in that.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think we've been asked to use this to face that way so that the recording will pick people up. All right,
so you guys use that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to facilitate this or moderate this so that everybody has a chance to speak. There's many people who have many interesting things to say, given, I'm sure, the given the what I expect to be a lot of just a lot of comments and a lot of dialogue, I want to ask you all to just keep your comments relatively short so that people can be able to start with you.
So my name is Robert.